Stick Wrestling Podcast. My name is John McAdam. It feels like I haven't done this in forever, but it's finally time to do it again. You are listening to the only wicked good wrestling podcast on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Give us 60 minutes and we will give you a Mondo podcast. I want to bring in my co-host, Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you today?
John, the more you do this, the more you sound like that guy pitching the hair in the can. Remember him?
I remember the guy 30-minute infomercials.
Yeah, was it Ron Papil, I think his name was?
I don't remember the dude, but they sold out of that stuff. They could not manufacture it enough quickly enough when it first came out to satisfy the need. And, of course, it was all garbage. Sean, let me ask you, why do we call this the Stick to Wrestling Podcast?
Well, because we don't talk about anything outside. We don't bring up politics. We don't bring up major events of the day, like, you know, the Super Bowl. We have a new champions crowned. We're excited about
that's
that.
Coming up very soon.
You get some fresh blood in every once in a while. It's good. You know, get some new teams in there. It's exciting.
Right. We don't talk about how the New England Patriots have been in 9 of the last 18 Super Bowls, for example. We don't talk about like how Tom Brady is knocking on Babe Ruth's door as like the greatest player in team sports history. We don't talk about how the New England Patriots, their dynasty is the modern equivalent of any of the Yankees dynasties, the Canadiens dynasty, UCLA basketball, or anything. We don't talk about the New England Patriots.
So, Jamie, how can you figure out whose idea this was yet?
Probably both of you. All I got to say
the phone
is...
On the phone with us, I need to let people know who this guy is. Jamie Ward, my old pal from Philadelphia. I have known him for like 32 years. How are you, Jamie?
I'm wonderful, John. How are you guys?
Of course, Jamie is the fan of the noble Philadelphia Eagles, who had a great season last year. And, you know, I hate to admit it, but they were the better team that day. So
they were.
My hat's off to them then. But so that was the whole point of our little bits in the beginning. So, but
I was to antagonize the audience too.
True.
So anyway, I've known Jamie forever, and I'm glad to have him on. He's been on Arcadian Vanguard stuff before, and he's done an awesome job, a wicked good job. That's why we're going to have him on. And today we're going to do something a little bit different on STW, something that we've never really done before. We're going to focus on one specific wrestler, and we're going to speak about that wrestler for 60 minutes or whatever we have left over. But I want to tell a quick story about Jamie. We are almost like 30 years to the day where a bunch of us went to Philadelphia for a trip, you know, a wrestling trip. We went to the Civic Center on Saturday night to see wrestling. And on the Friday before, we all went to Jamie Ward's house to see the Saturday night, not the Saturday night main event, the Friday night WWF special that they had on primetime, where it was Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan tagging in the main event against Akeem and Big Boss Man, and they did the big Randy Savage turn. And yeah, we were, how many people were at your house, Jamie, like crammed into the living room?
Had to be anywhere from 25 to 30 people.
It was crowded. I remember that.
We had at least 12 to 13 sitting on the floor. The sofa was jam-packed, as was two people in my dad's recliner and probably a couple more on the love seat. I mean, it was really crowded.
That was a really fun trip. And I remember one thing I specifically remember, of course, the late, great Harry White and I are sitting there cracking jokes about everything. And Dave Meltzer, because he actually has a job to do, which is to report what's going on, is yelling at us to shut up. And he needs to focus on what's going on in the television set. It's Dave, so we have to listen to him.
Yeah, we did. But well, we still, you know, we had a great time. And I just remember by the end of the night, Harry White asking if he could sleep on my floor.
Yeah, Harry had a bad back. He needed to, like, sleep on floors and stuff. But anyway, you know, just to give an idea of what some of these trips were like, and we're going to get to the Wyndham thing quickly. Don't worry about it. Like, I think that night we all went out to some bar nightclub thing, and this girl comes up to me, and she's like, you know, hey, what are you guys, a sports team or something? Because in a bar, like, not, you know, there's not going to be 30, 35 guys who all know each other, but we all did.
Yeah, your memory's better than mine. I can't remember but I remember going out.
All right. So anyway,
if you're ever going to do something wrong, don't do it in front of John. He will remember.
He's got an amazing memory. He had an amazing memory 30 years ago.
Oh, I'm so flattered, gentlemen. But anyway, I didn't do something wrong in front of me. Jamie, you've never done anything wrong in front of me, have you? If you did, I don't remember it.
Not that I remember.
Okay, there you go.
Or willing to admit.
So anyway, Barry Windham, Jamie, when was the first time you heard of him, and when was the first time you saw him?
Well, probably the first time I ever heard him and saw him was on the same thing, watching Florida Wrestling on the old satellite program network every Saturday afternoon. World League Wrestling with Lars Anderson had several different promotions on it. And one of the promotions that they had matches from was Florida. And Barry was on that show. And then, of course, on Sunday nights, also on the satellite program network, they ran the Florida shows, probably about 2 months behind. But that was the first time I ever saw Barry and actually ever heard of him.
Same here. I had never seen his name in a wrestling magazine before I saw him on the same network. As a matter of fact, I want to say sometime like late 1980, maybe mid 1980, the Lars Anderson show went bye-bye and the Florida show was on regularly. It was on at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. And believe it or not, sometimes I actually missed that one for no other reason than I could catch it. I think it was on 10:30 on Sunday nights. And I would stay up and watch it.
Right. Yeah. 10:30. It was on. Right. Exactly.
And I've heard over the years that when Barry was being trained out in Amarillo, the Funks helped train him. Obviously Blackjack helped train him. Right away, everyone saw him and said, this guy is going to be a future superstar. I mean, did you see that in him in 1980?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he was, before Lex Luger, he was the total package. Even skinny as a rail, the guy could just move. You just knew it was coming.
Now, you see, I didn't. I was like, okay, this guy, you know, he's about as tall as a basketball player, but he has the physique of a swimmer. And I was kind of not right away was I a big fan of his. Sean, have you seen any of his footage from like when he first started?
Sure. I saw some of the early Florida stuff when he had the feud with Morocco. He was involved in the early Kevin Sullivan feud a little bit, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, as a matter of fact. Someone named Nivek Navalis was putting out a bounty. This is like mid-82 to, you know, you get a certain amount of money. It was a weird amount of money for every bone you broke on Barry Windham.
And Barry, if you're curious of who Nivek is, write it down and put it in the mirror.
Write the words Kevin Sullivan backwards. And so someone, I think it was Jake Roberts, broke Barry Windham's nose, which isn't a bone, but whatever. And yeah, that Barry was involved in that. I mean, early on, like I remember, Jamie, tell me if you remember this. I have not seen it since it happened, but they had a babyface versus babyface match against Dick Murdoch on. I want to say this is like summer of 1980. And you know what happens in every babyface versus babyface match? Someone turns.
I do not remember that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I just don't.
You might have been doing something productive that day. Who knows? Unlike me.
I remember Sunday night I fell asleep.
That's a possibility too. I think we were both in high school at the time.
The first time I had a chance to see him was 85. I was 10 years old, and was it 85 when they came in as the U.S. Express?
Like fall, very end of the fall, 1984. I want to say
they were over huge.
They were over.
I mean, Hogan, just because he was so old, you know, it almost minimalized what they were doing. But I mean, outside of him, who was more over than them? I mean, they were way over, right from when they got in there, when they won the belts from Adonis and Murdoch. Quick question about that. I heard that Adonis didn't want to drop it to them, and Dickie talked him into it.
I had not heard that story before, but, I mean, well, at that time.
I heard that, Sean.
You have?
Is there anything to it?
Yeah, I did. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but I had heard that, you know, back in the day.
I mean, geez, that sounds awfully odd. I'm not sure why Adrian Adonis would care, really, who he lost the tag team titles to.
I mean, I can see why Dickie would intervene, because he probably knew him from the old days, and I guess they were close.
Well, it's yeah, he and Blackjack were close, and it's Blackjack's kid.
Well, they called an audible on that, didn't they? Weren't they going to give the Briscoes the belt? And then Jack quit, and that was the end of that, so they decided to go the Wyndham route?
You know what? I have heard that. I am more inclined to think. Here's what happened. Barry came into the WWF in 1984. And the first time he was on TV, he was by himself. And then I want to say a week or two later, they brought Rotunda in. And on Rotunda's first TV match, he was teamed with Wyndham, and they just went the tag team route. And just a little
they
bit.
They were actually
up,
on.
What's that?
I was going to say, they actually appeared on a Tuesday Night Titans before Rotunda ever appeared on television.
Okay. See, you've
with
got
Blackjack,
a good memory.
All three of them. Hey, stupid stuff sticks. that's what my wife tells me all the time.
There you go. And the way Barry got to the WWF, and this is something I heard a long time ago, and I think I've mentioned it on this show, he was supposed to get Magnum TA's push in Mid-Atlantic as, you know, Dusty's sidekick. And he was going to get a huge push. He was going to beat Wahoo for the United States title. And I guess Barry he wasn't happy with the money when he first started and got an offer from the WWF and left with very little notice.
Yeah, I understand that's the story also.
Imagine he may have made the right move there. I mean, again, they were over. I mean, they must have got taken care of in New York.
I mean, everyone did.
Yeah.
The money was
especially
great
them,
there.
They were, you could roll them out in the main event.
When Barry first got there as a single, and this didn't last long, I was like, you know, here's a guy who could easily take the Intercontinental title from Greg Valentine. He could, you know, he was a big enough star and a good enough performer where I thought he could do that no problem.
Oh, no question about it. It is underrated how over they were when they were there. I mean, I was stunned when they lost to the flippin' Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, you know, combined age of 130 at that point.
I think you're exaggerating. It was like 127.
Yeah, what was that? Even then, I was looking at this like, what are they doing?
I think I've asked you this before, Sean, but did you go see – you're talking about it. Did you go see the first WrestleMania?
I saw it in one of the – they had those closed circuit events.
Okay, where'd you go?
It was Brockton High School.
Oh wow! Okay, now Jamie, how about you? Where did you go? Did you see it live?
No, I did not see the first WrestleMania. Believe it or not.
Wow!
I had to work. I had to work.
That'll do it for you. I actually had the opportunity to go to New York to see the first WrestleMania, and I turned it down because I had already purchased my tickets to go see the closed circuit in the Worcester Centrum. But anyway, the whole story I heard behind that is that kind of last minute, they decided that they wanted to have a title change, not just Wendy Richter beating Leilani Kai, but a title change at the first WrestleMania, which at the time I think they might have thought was the only WrestleMania. So they just talked Wyndham and Rotunda into doing a quickie with the titles, but I have heard over the years that Barry was not too happy about that at all.
It was madness. Whoever's idea that was, then have Greg drop the damn belt.
Which was on the table.
I mean, they were crazy. I mean, Hogan was above everyone else, but right below that was them. Never mind Junkyard Dog. They were above Junkyard Dog.
I actually thought JYD was winning on that card.
Yeah, I did too.
I thought
JYD was winning the title.
For that reason, because you figured there had to be a title change. There's no way Hulk's losing. Or you know, there was no belt with him either, but there was no way he was losing anyway. And there was no way I figuring that Rotunda and Windham were losing. What did I know?
No, if you look back and let's say you go back in time and you're booking that, I mean, and you say and Vince says to you, okay, I've got to have a title change. Pick one. I'm picking JYD winning the Intercontinental title. It's early 1985. He's still over. He's not in great shape, but he's not what he was in like 88, 89, 90.
And I just lost it. I had the most amazing thought right there, and it just drifted off from me. I know. I'll think about it in a minute, but I just want to ask you guys something. I was reading about his early days in 1981, and obviously he was a very, very natural kind of talent. But he was skinny. It was up until like 1984 until he started to fill out a little bit. I had heard from Barry in one of his interviews prepping for this, because you guys know more about this topic than I do. That he was considered for the NWA title in 1981. I'm not favored, but like in the discussion.
I guess it depends on how broad in the discussion means. I could not see that happening.
I mean, was he maybe thinking like one of those Tommy Rich numbers?
I hope not. I think that would have been as it did to Tommy Rich. I think that would have done more harm to his career than good.
I agree, because from the stuff I saw, I mean, you saw the definite potential there, but you're looking at him like he's just too thin.
He wasn't there yet.
And yeah,
he was only established in Florida.
Well, in 81 is when he actually leaves Florida for a little bit and becomes Black Jack Jr.
That was the next thing I was going to talk about. Barry,
he goes to Georgia Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did that in Knoxville. He did that in Georgia. I think he appeared as Blackjack Mulligan Jr. in Georgia as well.
Yes.
Oh, with that awful mustache.
You know, when I was 16 when I first saw that, and they teased it in the After magazines. They were like, you will never see the name Barry Windham printed in one of these magazines ever again. We'll tell you why soon. And meanwhile, on the Florida show, they talked about Barry getting into some horrible car accident. So I don't know what to think. And then the Inside Wrestling, I think it was January 1982, has Barry with his hair dyed black and this awful fake black mustache with a cowboy hat on the cover.
And that's exactly what I was just about to mention. I can still vividly picture that.
I mean, I just remember, you know, going into the drugstore where I purchased my magazines at this point, just being taken aback by that visual because, you know, I'd seen Barry in Florida. I had no idea that Blackjack Mulligan was his dad. They never mentioned that. They never hinted towards it. And then you see this, like I said, this – and now I'm questioning what – you know, I didn't – how do you know it's wrestling? I'm like, is Barry really this guy's kid, or are they just, you know, lying to us as usual?
What are you doing? You have a perfect pure white bread baby face sitting right there. Absolutely perfect. Just need some developing, and you slap a black mustache on him. Nice job. Idiots.
Here's the defense. I can defend it even though I don't agree with this defense, that Blackjack Mulligan was such a huge name in the business, especially in the Carolinas, that having Barry – as his son, you know, that was the defense of it, that Blackjack was such a big deal that now we've got Blackjack Part 2.
I guess, but did he have to look like him?
Good question.
No, that's
wrestling. That is wrestling.
It's a perfectly good-looking guy. Hey, maybe we get some girls in here. No, let's have him look like Blackjack Mulligan instead. that's genius.
Now, let me ask you guys this.
I can't imagine why Vince kicked these guys' ass.
let me ask you this, though. Given the fact that Blackjack was a big deal in Mid-Atlantic and they planned on pushing Barry, do you think it would have made sense to just call him Barry Mulligan?
I can't even get past the mustache. I can't get to that point.
But I'm talking like long term here. I mean, you know, let's say they had just gone with that and stuck with it, and he could do the old, yeah, I wanted to be called Barry Windham for a little while because it's a town in New Hampshire, and I didn't want to live off my dad's name or have the bad guys target me because I'm Blackjack's kid.
I would say long term, no, because he was able to become his own guy. I mean, because by having him be like Blackjack Mulligan Jr. and then go to Barry Windham, you were able to make a complete break, or go back, I should say.
All right, Jamie, what do you think?
You got to remember at the time that he becomes Blackjack Jr., there's another famous Jr. that comes on the scene, as in Bruno Sammartino Jr.
Now, I always thought that was a huge mistake, calling him that.
Oh, absolutely. He should have just been David all along. But they went the Bruno Jr. route, and, you know, it really hurt him, and he never recovered from it. But maybe they were hoping for different results out of Barry being Blackjack Jr.
I mean, that really is a good comparison. You're right. It happened right around the exact same time.
Yeah, but I mean, how could you see anything, even at the time? I mean, oh, I remember what my thought was. So, yeah, so if you have the same opinion when you have this kind of more innocent mindset, and then when you have that opinion again when you're 43, you know it's, you know, you don't have that same kind of belief in it, it has to be the right thing. Because both sides of your brain are agreeing, your wrestling brain.
Wrestling brains. We got three of them right here on Stick to Wrestling. But anyway, yeah, so Barry, they finally dump out of that Blackjack Mulligan Jr. thing. They give up on it. Barry eventually goes back to Florida. This is like early, mid-1982. And at this point, he is becoming established as a real star, established as, you know, a guy who could hold the Florida heavyweight championship, a guy who could possibly, you know, see not right away, but down the road, this guy winning the NWA title. And there are very few guys that you could say that about, like, wow, I could see him as NWA champ.
Why did Vince let him walk away? This seemed like a perfect Vince guy.
Well, I can answer that. Barry, well, let's back up a little bit. Blackjack has always had the reputation as someone who was a bit of, and this is just a promoter's perspective, a bit of an attitude problem, a bit of a hothead. Blackjack, you know, if Billy Jack Haynes didn't exist, we'd be talking about Blackjack Mulligan as the guy who was constantly up and quitting. And I think a little of Blackjack rubbed off on Barry. And if Blackjack's the guy giving Barry advice, that's not necessarily good news. So what I've always heard was Barry didn't like losing the tag team titles, even though he and Rotundo essentially got them right back. He didn't like doing the job at WrestleMania. And his attitude went south. And as a result, they put the titles on who did they win them for? Now, oh my God, I've gone brain
Dream
dead.
Team, was it?
Valentine.
Yeah, Dream Team.
Okay, right. Which was an absolute stunner for me at the time, because I didn't think Greg Valentine, you know, I thought they were just an occasional tag team together, and nope, they put them on Valentine and Beefcake, and I've always heard in part because they were starting to sour on Barry.
How much did Hogan have it to do with that? Was that one of those things where Hogan kind of looked at him as possible competition?
You never know. I mean, Hogan was really good at taking care of himself and wiping out, you know, cutting off potential threats really early at the pass. I mean, I've always heard he's the one that got it in Duggan's head. You know, don't do what you did in Mid-South up here. You got to be way over the top cartoonish. And that's one reason of many why Duggan never really got over up here.
And didn't he also do that to Steamboat?
I had never heard that.
I thought he was worried that the WrestleMania 3 match had outshined his.
I mean, it certainly did from a technical standpoint. I don't know. I really can't say. But yeah, we're, you know, at some point not long after losing the titles to Valentine and Beefcake, Wyndham and Rotundo, they were just another tag team for a little while, and then Barry split, goes back to Florida. Any thoughts on that, Barry, gentlemen?
I wonder if Barry had any influence on the Mr. Florida cigar, burning the eye with the cigar when they lost the tag belts.
I mean, you're right. They did the thing with Mr. Florida, Paul Jones under a hood, when Barry was there. But I don't know. Maybe it's a good connection there, though.
Why is he going to Florida at this point?
That is the ultimate question. Barry, the 1985 Barry Windham heading back to Florida is about the equivalent of Patrick Mahomes saying, yeah, I'm going to go play for the Montreal Alouettes. It made no sense, especially in the midst of a wrestling war. I know why he wasn't in the WWF. He, you know, obviously his relationship, from what I've heard, with the brass there had become strained. I understand why he didn't go back to the Carolinas, because I think Dusty was still mad at him over walking out a year earlier. Where's Bill Watts?
Great question.
Yeah.
He would have been tailor-made for Mid-South.
He's tailor-made anywhere. Yeah, he's a bigger Terry Taylor.
Yeah, I mean, Wyndham, you know, and you have to understand, by 1985, Mid-South was still doing really well, but Florida had become a decidedly minor league promotion compared to WWF, Mid-Atlantic, and Watts, Mid-South Wrestling. Those were the three big players. The AWA had kind of fallen off a little bit. Maybe still comparable to Mid-South, but Florida, I mean, guys were struggling down there.
How did Barry and Rotundo, just a random off-the-wall question, how did Barry and Rotundo end up in the WrestleRock Rumble?
I think, you know, it's funny, that show was kind of the, Vern Gagne's, like, last hurrah. We talked about that. And I think they were just trying to attract the top talent that was available from around the country on the show.
See, this is what happens when I don't have detailed notes in front of me. My mind just gets all random. Anyway, how much in 1985 did that for you guys? Cause I'm asking questions cause you guys know a lot more about this than I do. I was a very young fan at this point. How much did this hurt? Because, I mean, this is prime time right here. And he's messing around in Florida. And Florida's on – I mean, you're being kind. Florida's on life support by 1985. So, I mean, he's just – really? You're there? I mean, there are so many different options. I mean, even Houston's better option at this point.
Here's one possibility, and that is that maybe Barry, I mean, I think he's from Florida. I think he grew up there. I think maybe he just liked it there, and he was willing to just take some time and hang out there for a year or so, whatever, and not, you know, have to worry about the wrestling business. You know, maybe he correctly figured that the wrestling business would come back to him at some point, because working for Watts, you made a lot of money, but it wasn't easy.
And maybe he was just burned out from the WWF schedule that time. Those guys are working 6-7 days a week, double shots on weekends. Maybe he just had enough and just said, let me go back home, take it easy, figure out my next landing place.
You know, that's an excellent thought, Jamie, because you're right. The WWF in 1985, you were working as many as 9 shows a week. Now stop and think about that. That's crazy. And you had guys, you know, collapsing at airports, crisscrossing across the country. I mean, think about having to make 4 shows in 2 days, which the guys did sometimes on Saturdays and Sundays.
What happens if he ends up on Joe Blanchard's able to get him while they're still on USA?
They were long off USA by they got off USA like fall of 1983.
So they were off by then. Okay, I thought it was later.
All right, that's cool.
I'm looking at avenues where he could have been here and made a massive impact. I'd like to say Dallas, but I mean, you know, he's never going to get past the boys, so there's no point there. But yeah, Mid-South, I mean, pretty much anywhere other than where he went.
And think about it, Blackjack Mulligan was in world class like spring 1986. And I don't know, maybe he could have, maybe he did pitch the idea of bringing in Barry as a heel to go against the Von Erichs. I mean, they needed somebody.
Yeah, okay, yeah. If you use them on the heel side of the spectrum, or, you know, use them with in some kind of tandem with some version of the Freebirds.
What's that?
There's no way Fritz is bringing him in to team up with his boys and possibly take any popularity away from him.
Yeah, no, that was not going to happen.
That's what I'm saying. At that point, that's where he would be at his best. It seems like the lost years, especially when you see Battle of the Belts 3. You're like, oh, my God, this could be on the national television audience, right? This can be in front of a national television audience that week in, week out.
I'll tell you something. I remember watching the first Battle of the Belts live. No, it wasn't the first one. It was was Barry versus Flair Battle of the Belts 2 or 3?
Three, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Okay. Let me see. I know Flair Wahoo was the first one, and now my memory's drawing a blank, but I do remember that Barry Windham had the match on Valentine's Day in 1986. It was on syndicated TV, and I was such a great boyfriend, I let my girlfriend watch that with me at home, and that's what we did that night. But it was one of the best matches I've ever seen.
I mean, he – and so – okay, so finally we have the lost years. And then what's happened to bring him back to Jim Crockett? And this would have been 86 or 87, late 86?
It was right around fall 86. I want to say it was after Magnum's accident that he actually debuted. A lot of people say, oh, they brought in Barry to because Magnum had the accident. I mean, they were either – close to finalizing or had finalized his return to JCP by that point. So it wasn't, even though it may have looked cause and effect, it really wasn't.
So was it Dusty brought him in?
It was, from what I've heard, Crockett kind of talked Dusty into it. They kind of talked Dusty into having a meeting where Barry assured him that, you know, he wasn't going to go anywhere and that, you know, he didn't want to be in the WWF anymore. He wanted to be in JCP, and it all worked out. And it was great in the beginning because we talked about, you know, Ric Flair versus Barry Windham, February 86. He and Barry Windham in early 87, when Flair desperately needed a new opponent after the Nikita Koloff series finished, had some of the best matches. I mean, that had to be one of the best go-rounds ever.
That match they had on during – was it one of the classes? It was – they took up an entire show. It was a 60-minute match. Was it – which show was it, John?
It was Worldwide.
That was as good a match as you're going to see.
Jamie, any thoughts on Barry Windham when he first got back with JCP in 1986?
Yeah, well, you know, when he first came in, I'm thinking, all right, how's Dusty going to screw him over this time? But but he gave Barry a decent push, and then Barry just really took off, like Sean was just mentioning, that hour, what was it, a time limit draw, right?
Sean? Yeah. Yep.
Worldwide Wrestling? Yep. That is the one that catapulted Windham for the rest of his run in JCP.
I agree.
The funny part, that my favorite part about that match, well, aside of the match itself, was right afterwards, Dusty almost had a look of shock on his face. Like, there was a moment pause, and he just kind of shook his head and grinned and said, that was a hell of a match! Just something out of nowhere. Like he's convincing himself that this happened. Tell me about the Dusty-Barry relationship.
From what I heard going back to Florida, it was on and off. It was, you know, I mean, and any time, let's face it, you have a guy who's, I don't know, a talent, and then you have a guy who's the boss, which Dusty was, it's not always going to run smoothly. And I heard that they had some dust-ups, you know, going back to their Florida days. And, you know, once Barry became established in JCP, kind of, you know, relaxed a little bit. And like I said, the relationship, from what I understand, could run hot and cold.
When did the Horseman decision come about? And whose idea was it? Was it Rick?
The Horseman thing was really weird. And I think Jamie could definitely relate to this. When Lex Luger quit the Horseman and turned at the end of 1987, for the first, I want to say, 10 or 11 weeks, it was right around there, because Barry turned right before the Crockett Cup. All anyone wanted to know in the sheets, the Pro Wrestling Underground, whatever you want to call it, is who's going to be the fourth horseman. Jamie, am I right?
Can you repeat that one, John? They broke up on me.
Oh, that's okay. In early 1988, after Luger left the horseman, all anyone wanted to know, the number one question, is who is going to be the new horseman. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, that was just like who the next person in the NWO was going to be.
Yeah.
Same exact parallel. And to be honest with you, I mean, I may have read it at the time, but I didn't see it coming.
That was a great turn that night. It was. And here's what I heard at the time. I know Kurt Hennig, they had thought about, and they had actually talked to him about it, and for whatever reason, he decided to wait it out with the WWF. But they didn't offer it to him per se, but I know it had been discussed with him. And then, you know, there was talk of the Road Warriors turning and becoming horsemen, which sort of – I mean, it happened that year that they turned, and it happened that year that there were serious discussions of making them part of the Four Horsemen. There was talk about the Midnight Express somehow getting in there. And I remember that Saturday watching WTBS. I believe it was the Saturday of the Crockett Cup tournament when it started. It was Lex Luger and Barry Windham against Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, a rematch from when Lex and Barry won the titles at the Clash. And just out of nowhere, they did this turn where Luger got knocked off the apron or something, and Barry's getting beat up, and JJ says to him, "I told you he was going to do this to you," or something like that. And Barry just turned on Luger, gives him the clothesline. And then they had that surreal thing, like the Midnight Rider follows Barry to the back and they get into the brawl. And they had that unbelievable finish of the show where Barry gets in the Cadillac or the limo, whatever it was with the horseman, and he holds up the Midnight Rider's mask with one hand.
Oh, that
and
was
with
great.
His other hand, just puts up four fingers, like, "I am part of the Four Horsemen now."
Now, I didn't think Barry's going to have it in him, because, you know, as Jamie was saying, this, it seems obvious now, but Barry was never this kind of heel before. I mean, this was a full-blown, this wasn't one of those little kind of just the personalities. This was a full-blown Ted DiBiase. I go from, you know, as I was telling John, go from, you know, helping ladies across the street to running them down.
Great comparison.
Like at the drop of a hat, and it fit like a glove.
Wyndham's name had been brought up as a possible horseman replacement, and I was like, you know, the only reason I thought they were doing it was because they'd kind of run out of things to do with him. They, in 87, once his run with Flair was over, they gave him that ridiculous Western States Heritage title for no other reason than, what do we do with Barry Windham? Let's put a belt on him. You know, you're out of creative steam when you're doing stuff like that.
Yeah, but
Go ahead.
He had that run with Ronnie Garvin as the U.S. Tag Champs.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because he won the U.S. Tag Team titles with Garvin, and then he won – was it the Western States title that he won, and he had to give up the Tag Team titles?
I believe you're right.
So I'm thinking, well, this is a natural Ronnie Garvin turn coming up. And that didn't happen until the next year. But I thought for sure that storyline was leading towards Garvin turning on Barry. You know, hey, you made me drop my belt.
After that they had a really good stretch of like 87 to 88 with Barry. But when did Barry, what happened where he kind of, you know, where he ended up going back to the WWF?
Well, I'll tell you, and I just want to, before we get to that, because I have a story about that. But anyway, I was like you. I was like, you know, we'd never seen Barry as a heel before. He was always such a natural baby face. Didn't even seem to have like a real, like, I don't know, a dark side to him. And he was magnificent as a heel.
What do you think of him and Hogan in the main event of a major event?
This is what I'm saying. Like, I saw Barry Windham at this point as a possible long-term NWA champion, or I saw him as a possible WrestleMania opponent for Hogan. That's what a big star I thought he was going to be.
Oh, it was it was so shockingly and you can tell he was enjoying it. That's how you could tell a good heel, when you could tell they're enjoying it.
And, you know, Barry, I want to emphasize, he was so big physically at this point. He had filled out,
he could have been Black Jack Jr. at this point, body-wise.
Yes. And, I mean, Jamie, I think you were around me when one night I just got lucky and got to spend, like, I don't know, a good half hour, 40 minutes talking to Ric Flair, and Barry Windham was, you know, just coming in and out of the conversation. And Barry just, you know, we're in a bar full of wrestlers, and Barry towers over everybody.
Actually, if I could make a quick correction one moment, old Eagle Eye Lou Kippelman just reminded us of something here. Garvin had the Mid-Atlantic title when he and Barry won the U.S. tag belts. Garvin vacated the Mid-Atlantic title. A future tournament was mentioned, but never happened. So.
Oh, thank you, Lou, to the rescue again. But yeah, that is right. He gave up the old Mid-Atlantic title, and that title wound up being retired, you know, way after it should have been. So anyway, now going back, like I said, I think we were all in agreement that Barry's 1988 run with the Horsemen was incredible.
Yes, perfect.
Absolutely.
So then JCP kind of collapses right before Columbus Day weekend 88, where I was hanging out with Jamie, among other people, in Memphis. Word had gotten out that Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard had jumped off the sinking ship known as JCP and went to the WWF, which means we now have two Horsemen spots available. I don't even want to get into the whole desperate, you know, let's bring in these guys. I thought by that point the Horsemen needed to go. What, Jamie, what do you think of that? We're talking like fall 88 here.
Yeah, fall 88. Tully and Arn dropped the belts of Midnight Express in September. And,
were you there?
I was there. I went out with Cornette and Bobby and Stan and Dennis Carluzzo and Frankie the Thumper. We all went out and celebrated the championship after the show.
That's right. You were there. That must have been crazy, just being in the audience and seeing the belt switch hands.
Oh, it was, because we were actually backstage for it, and Cornette didn't even tell us about it. I mean, we were able to watch through the curtain. We had no idea they were winning the belts, and they didn't know until they got there that night they were winning the belts.
Yeah, Arn Anderson had said that the only, you know, they were considering just leaving without dropping the belts. And I guess it was Arn who kind of decided that, you know, I'll tell you what, we'll give the Midnights a going away present and lose the titles to them. I'd seen it reported in magazines that, you know, it was one, I think it was Wrestling Eye, said it was a phantom title change. I was like, no, I knew a bunch of people who were there, including yourself.
Oh yeah. And it's not like, Arn and Tully just took the night off. They had their working shoes on that night. It was a great match.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. I've actually seen clips of it.
I was going to say, isn't there like handheld camera stuff of this match?
Yeah. Cornette had somebody film.
A guy named Scott Goldstein stuck a camera in there, and he recorded it. And then when he saw that the titles changed hands, there was another big match that night, Flair and Luger. And he's like, there's no way I'm letting this taking the chance of getting caught recording and having my camera or tape or whatever taken away from me. So he just like stopped recording and put it away.
Scott Goldstein, there's a name I haven't heard in years.
I remember Scott. He was a good guy. He was always around when we were in Philly.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, now this is a something I wanted to share with the Stick to Wrestling audience. This is something I heard. Wow, we're looking at almost exactly 30 years ago this happened. JCP gets bought out by Turner. And Turner, you know, they're not going to do the wrestling business the way it's always been done. I'm not saying that they're going to treat the wrestlers exactly the way they treated someone on the Atlanta Braves or the Atlanta Hawks. But it wasn't going to be, you know, these weird contracts with balloon payments. You know, you guys are going to be more or less employees. You're going to have contracts and you're going to have salaries. Now, backing up a little bit, I used to know someone who was very well connected in JCP, and I spoke with this person a few days before the Chi-Town Heat pay-per-view, and I was like, you know, hey, is Steamboat going to win the title still? And his answer was, yeah, that's still on the board. But it's like anything else in that company, it might change the night of the event, which is true. You know, whatever was on paper, you know, don't count on it until it actually happens. But he goes, but the title change I know is going to happen is Lex Luger's winning the U.S. title from Barry Windham. And I was floored. I was totally not expecting that. And he goes on to say, well, after that match, Barry, this is what I've been told. Barry had just signed a new contract with the company. They tore up his old JCP contract. They gave him a new one. He got a sizable signing bonus. If I recall correctly, it was like $40,000 or $50,000, $1989. And they agreed to give him 6 weeks off to get his hand operated on. So, you know, so he's losing the title. So he's going to be out for 6 weeks. Well, they, you know, someone from the office is trying to get in touch with Barry over the 6 week period to see how he's doing, give him his bookings for when he comes back, whatever. Barry disappears off the face of the earth. And apparently he took his signing bonus, bought a new Mercedes, and was just, you know, living the high life and forgetting all about wrestling. So Jim Herd, from what I understand, gets a call from Blackjack Mulligan, and Mulligan's, you know, and by this point, Jim Herd is furious. And he gets a call from Mulligan, and Blackjack is like, Barry says to give him a call at this number, and which Jim Herd took as an insult and an amazing.
He should have.
Yeah. I mean, if this story is true, I totally see Jim Herd's side of it. And he decides that he's just going to cut his losses, not going to try to get the signing bonus back, and he cans Barry, which is what led to his departure from JCP. And supposedly the worst part for Herd is that everyone was laughing at him. All of the wrestlers in the company were having a laugh at his expense. You know, they brought this guy from the outside in, and he doesn't know how things go around here. You don't just hand a wrestler $40,000. That makes you a rube. And supposedly that is what soured Jim Herd to the wrestling business in general and why he turned out to be such a shit.
Well, you figured he'd get used to it after a while.
He got introed very quickly to this, and I more or less believe this story because this person was telling it to me live as it happened. I mean, I remember the day I got the call, and he's like, guess what? WCW fired Barry Windham, and then he gave me all that information, and I'm like, this is the same guy who told me that that Windham was dropping the U.S. title.
So now Barry is unemployed again with how many options?
Well, there's Japan.
There's Tony Santos in New England's under, so he can't do that. So now he has to go back to the place. And by the way, to go back, we're talking about him dropping when you said, well, he's going to win the belts back anyway. Nobody remembers that they won the belts back. everybody remembers that they dropped the belts to Nikolai and Iron Sheik. So in retrospect, Barry was white. Right. So Barry has to go back to this guy again. What's he thinking?
He didn't go back right away. And once again, I hate to be the there's a story out there guy, but I'll bet both of you have heard this one. Supposedly in 89, after Barry got canned, he had a rich girlfriend. And she did not want him on the road doing the wrestling business, doing the things on the road that guys in the wrestling business do. She wanted him to stay at home. And again, I kind of believe this story because A, it came from a credible source, and B, I heard it not in 2009, but in 1989. Those are the stories that tend to be true.
I've heard something along the lines of that.
Okay.
So did this have anything to do with him coming back as the Widowmaker?
Probably
was that a little
joke? You know what? And we almost forgot to mention, I hate going backwards, but when Barry turned heel, they gave him the claw hold a la Blackjack Mulligan. I wanted to throw that in because that was an acknowledgement they made that he was Blackjack's kid.
He should not need an acknowledgement. That this should not be necessary at this point. He was a big enough of a star. But what condition did he come back when he came back? What condition was he in?
Oh, when he came back as the Widowmaker in 89?
Yeah.
It looked like Barry was enjoying some pasta dishes.
Yeah, he was on the Robert De Niro Raging Bull diet.
Yeah, he was definitely much heavier and out of shape. He was there to collect a paycheck.
And when he, you know, obviously when we hear that Barry Windham is finally, you know, we were all fans of Barry Windham. And when we all hear that he's finally back and finally, you know, in the wrestling business again, we're all excited. And we're thinking, you know, what can he do in the WWF? I was talking to somebody and I was surprised they would say something like this. They were like, oh, wow, Barry Windham is going to the WWF, you know, with Tully and Arn there, maybe the WWF can have the Four Horsemen against Hulk Hogan. And I was just like, even at that time, I was like, the WWF doesn't do stuff like that.
No, or they pretend it never happened.
They totally pretended it never happened. When he debuted, they called him the Widowmaker, but they acknowledged he was Barry Windham maybe for the first, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks he was there. Jamie, is that what you remember?
Yeah, because Vince would do that. Even like when Kerry Von Erich came in, the first TV taping or two, you know, it was Kerry Von Erich, the Texas Tornado, Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Tony
Atlas, Sabu Simba.
Tony Atlas. And they did mention that when Tony Atlas came back as Sabu Simba.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a common practice. Just to say it once or twice and then let the character take its own course after that.
In the case of Kerry, he almost had to because he was already a reasonably big star in the Northeast by the time he even showed up in WWF.
I always thought that was, I don't know, a little bit egotistical of the WWF to demand that even some of the biggest stars in wrestling, you know, yeah, we're going to completely tear you down and build you back up. I mean, we're talking about guys like Kerry Von Erich and Barry Windham, who are just huge stars.
I hated it. It broke up all continuity with the business. It was the one thing I that above anything else, I hated that. When they bring in Ronnie Garvin, I'd have no idea, you know, they wouldn't even mention it. I mean, come on, really? You have the former NWA champion here, and you're not going to bring that up?
Yeah, you know what? At this point, as far as the WWF was concerned, they were the only wrestling promotion that existed.
Exactly.
I mean, they did
didn't even want to acknowledge Flair when they brought Flair in. I mean, they just had Flair come in as the real world's heavyweight champion. You all know who he is.
Right. And I think the last time they even acknowledged any wrestler's past, the next time they acknowledged a wrestler's past, unless I'm forgetting somebody, was when they brought in Brian Pillman in 1997.
Yeah, but they were doing a whole weird thing with him, weren't they? Like with the, you know, eventually they did that bizarre Steve Austin angle.
Yeah, that was something else.
Yeah, that was kind of like a continuation of the whole Loose Cannon saga.
Yeah, but I mean, they would not acknowledge at all. I think they acknowledged that Goldust was Dusty Rhodes' son. But I mean, we're talking about, you know, a 7-year period where they said nothing about a wrestler's past.
But that's okay, because Dusty was there at one point, so they can make reference to that.
True. He was back. He was still in WCW with an on-camera role, but you know, that was it. He wasn't doing anything terribly important.
And he looked just like him. Let me ask you, this kind of depresses me a little bit, because I thought he could have been one of the two or three best of the decade. This could have been a decade of matches of Barry and Rick. Can you guys give me what could you imagine if you saw Barry at his absolute best? If he lived out his potential, what do we see? What is his career turned into?
Oh man, I mean, absolute ceiling for him would have been a long run as the NWA champion, and he's the guy who puts the promotion on his back and turns the promotion into a legit competitor to the WWF. How about you, Jamie?
Yeah, that's the way it could have turned out, but it also could have turned out where you had the guys like the Ric Flairs and the Dusty Rhodes and whoever else is still in power keeping the guy down so they don't lose their spots, and things just turn out the way they were.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It's a possibility. I mean, and here's the thing. Barry Windham, when he left WCW, had all of the potential in the world. He was not even 30 years old yet. And he goes to the WWF, and it should have been obvious to me from the get-go that they did not have big plans for him. And then I remember watching, I think it was on Primetime Wrestling one night, he went to a draw with Tito Santana. Now, I think instinctively a lot of people might say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Tito Santana was great. But Tito Santana by this point was nothing but, you know, I mean, he had been in the promotion for 6 years and he was just another guy on the roster.
How about this? Heel turn after he loses the belt, him and Hogan, WrestleMania 2.
You know what? They could have done that. I mean, if they had planned that out, that would have worked.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they could definitely could have got him over right then. But I can't yell at them about that, because I still, that was shocking to me. From the guy I saw in 1985 to what I saw, it was two separate guys. I mean, this was not a Ric Flair, just kind of Flair or Jerry when they have this, you know, we just happen to hate the same guys. But I'm still a jerk. You know, that kind of thing where they just tweak it a little bit. Barry would just completely overhaul the whole thing. It was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it even gets worse when him and JBL become the Blackjacks.
I
apologize
rarely
for bringing that up, but
no,
unfortunately,
that's okay.
That's like my last memories of him. Maybe the last good thing he actually does. Wasn't he part of the West Texas Rednecks?
Yes, he was. This is when I was not watching WCW, but I know he was part of that troupe.
And first of all, yeah, he has the mustache with the blackjack, so that's the first tip off right there. That's gonna be a disaster. And how depressing was the West Texas Rednecks? I mean, there were actually some good guys in that.
They were, and it just goes to show you like how overpopulated WCW's roster was at one point. And granted, they had a lot of television to produce, but I mean, it was like I was not even watching WCW at that point. I remember the day, it was in 1998. All that show did was get me mad. It was, you know, just an NWO ego trip week after week. And I'm like, I said to myself, why am I watching this? It gets me angry. It doesn't make me happy. I'm not Dave Meltzer. It's not my job. Goodbye, WCW.
You're seeing all your heroes run over.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? Going back to 89, once again, Barry Windham was supposed to be part of the Survivor Series. He left or was fired, whatever happened, a few weeks before that, and they kept advertising him because it's the WWF. And this time, people like myself who were Barry Windham fans had legitimate cause to worry, because now he had burned all of the bridges. I could not see him getting back with WCW. I could not see him getting back with the WWF. But what do you know? Right before Memorial Day 1990, I hear from obviously from someone who knew what they were talking about, because he did come back, that he was not just coming back. He was coming back and getting a spot on the Four Horsemen.
They did do that, didn't they?
They did. And I was, shocked. But from what I heard, Flair had strongly gone to bat for it. And I just was, again, amazed that they were putting the Horsemen back together. And it was going to be Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, who were the only Horsemen left standing. They were bringing back Barry Windham. And Sid Vicious was coming back from an injury. And they were going to put him in the unit. That was a bizarre set of Four Horsemen.
And
who did it end up being?
They went with those four for a while.
Those four, and wasn't Ole the mouthpiece also?
He was, and Ole was the guy who, because he was the booker, he was on TV all of the time, mixed up in every angle.
Yes, he was involved in the Sting turn, or where they turn on Sting, rather.
Yeah, that was February 1990, which to this day I think was extremely ill-advised. Maybe one day we'll go into a deep dive on this here on Stick to Wrestling. But yeah, so that's pretty much Barry Windham in the 80s and a little bit into 1990. I never felt like when Barry came back in 1990, it just wasn't the same. He just wasn't the same guy. Jamie, what do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Especially, when he finally gets the NWA belt, it wasn't that special.
No, it didn't matter anymore. Sean, what do you think of Windham?
The belt didn't matter anymore.
No, Sean, what do you think of Windham when he came back?
The belt didn't. Unfortunately, the belt didn't matter anymore, but James is absolutely correct. There was something in his eyes that wasn't there. If you look at him in like 87, 88, there was a spark. I mean, yeah. I don't know if he was bored. I don't know if, he didn't feel challenged. I mean, he never really was given a push worthy of him. I mean, worthy of his talents.
No, and maybe some of it was that he was overly humbled. I mean, I do know. I mean, how do you go back to Jim Herd looking for a job after if what I talked about earlier, if that happened, actually happened? From what I've always heard, Barry just went hat in hand and just kind of said, hey, I'll do whatever you guys want me to do. And remember when Halloween Havoc 90, when he was the fake Sting and he got that haircut? Supposedly that was part of the punishment.
Well, it was a great look. He pulled it off. They had me fooled at the moment.
They did. Same here.
I'm pretty sure Barry could have pulled off anything if he was interested.
Yeah. And, it's weird that they did that angle that night and never went back to it, because I could have gotten plenty of storyline out of that angle. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, absolutely. Let me ask you, how many guys can you think of? The one thing that always took me back about Barry was you can put him into any slot. You could put him into a tag team slot. You could put him into a babyface main event. You could put him into heel. You can have him in the number two spot like he was with Flair. How many guys can you think of who had that kind of versatility?
That's exactly it. He was extremely versatile, and, he was an outstanding worker, and I'm glad we got what we got out of Barry Windham. I am kind of sorry that it wasn't more, because, Sean, I think you put it really well. Like, there was just something about him after that the fire had been put out. Like, even when he was getting big pushes in 92, 93, whatever, that just never – it never felt like it did 4 or 5 years earlier.
To answer my own question from earlier, what I think would happen if he actually lived up to his potential, Ted DiBiase.
Yeah. That's, you know, actually, you're right. He could have been, I was going to say maybe he could have been bigger than DiBiase. Ted DiBiase was pretty damn big.
Ted DiBiase, except he could have even been a bigger babyface.
True, Ted. You know what? Ted, I never thought was a great babyface.
He was good. Yeah, he was good, but he wasn't great. Barry was great.
But a feud between those two with Watts pulling the strings would have been awesome.
With either in either role. That's the best part. You could keep switching them back and forth like a couple times because they could both pull it off.
Oh, yeah. They could run for years with that. Yeah. If you'd had Wyndham in Mid-South from 82, you could have run through 87, 88 with those two guys just switching roles all the time.
Yeah, because they were both so versatile, you could keep it fresh.
Nope. And Watts would have been the man to keep it fresh.
Yeah, exactly. And Ted DiBiase had a great wrestling mind himself. But anyway, I say this every week, the hour goes by too damn fast. Jamie, thank you for taking the time to be a guest on Stick to Wrestling. You will definitely be back. Thank you again.
Well, thank you for having me, John. Maybe next time we can talk about you buying my videotape collection.
We will definitely share that anecdote from, wow, it's been 20 years, man.
Either that or the bar experience in Memphis with the cab ride.
Oh, God. You see, Jamie, we've said earlier, don't do anything wrong in front of John. I'm the one who's always doing stuff wrong in front of Jamie Ward. Thank you. You know what? We're in overtime again. Jamie knew me when I was young, and Jamie, I mean, let's be honest, I was pretty fucking crazy.
True.
Anyway.
Well, we were both young then, so we both have excuses.
All right. Well, and Sean, thank you again for your contribution to Stick to Wrestling. You are greatly appreciated, sir.
Well, thank you, of course. I'm not used to saying anything at the end. I usually just let you ramble off.
Well, here I go rambling off. This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. I want to thank my good friend Luke Hippelman for producing the show. And we will see you all next week. We've got a cool show in mind. Tune us in.